This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Etienne Reniker from NTT Limited.
Ian, good afternoon, or I guess good day. NTT Limited is a newly formed entity, and we're part of the NTT Group, which is out of Japan. And it is actually the international businesses of the NTT Group that's now been come together under this one brand of NTT Limited. To give you just a quick snapshot, about 40,000 people trading in 74 countries around the world. The areas we cover include intelligent infrastructure, so all data center, cloud, all sorts of networking. It includes traditional workspace, all the workspace technologies, whether it be modern collaboration, all those wonderful technologies. We do business applications, particularly in the managed application space, and then cybersecurity. It's interesting. It doesn't sound like many domains. We just brought together 28 companies, and people say, well, you must be in more domains. And the answer is we are not. What has happened is that we've actually brought together a set of complementary assets that now give us a very complete set of offerings in each of those domains. So that's sort of the quick, short introduction.
You're CTO, but you're also an exception to many CTOs. You've been with this company over 28 years. You're invested in the history of the company, but also you've seen those domains grow. You know what the company can do. And as this now big merger goes ahead, it gives you a very specific understanding that a lot of CTOs don't have. They come in and they've suddenly got to stitch something together. How much does that make your life easier, or does it actually make your life more complicated?
Start by saying I've never been called a laugher, and it is an interesting term. So here's where it gets interesting. Firstly, I'll talk very openly. I have a passion for this industry. I love technology. I love what it can do. I love how it can change business, how it can change life. And I've seen it. I've lived through what I would call the waves. I've lived through client server. I've lived through internet. I've lived through the web. I've now lived through cloud, and I'm now living through IoT. Firstly, I'm massively privileged to have actually lived and have my career in a time of all these disruptions. In that, I've learned an amazing amount of how these things interact. I've learned about the interdependencies. I've learned, probably most importantly, how it impacts business. That does give me a good perspective. I'm not wedded to any specific technology or vendor. I'm really interested in driving the outcome. I would say that I've evolved to understand the architecture. To me, that's sort of the secret to the success for most people is if you get the architecture right, it determines where you'll go. It gives you the logic, being pragmatic about how you go about it, and then drive towards making a difference and executing. And at the end of the day, if you don't execute, the cool stuff doesn't really matter.
One of the advantages, and one of the reasons I mentioned how long you've been in role, is, of course, Dimension Data's one of the key three companies at the head of this bringing together. That means you've had a period of time working with the other two big companies, NTT Communications and NTT Security, plus a number of those subsidiaries, because there's a lot of cross-selling, a lot of cross-population. As you start to look now at what the company architecture will be and how you bring those assets together, how much is that a bonus for you?
I think that type of, I want to say corporate knowledge, but also married to industry and client demand knowledge is just helping us bring it together. Because it really helps you get down to what's important quickly. Mm-hmm. In big mergers, bringing 28 companies together, there's an interesting thing in my space. The things I own in the corporate CTO office, I own four key things. I own the technology strategy, as you would think, but I also own architecture. Now, it's interesting because we take an architecture out of the operational function of the CIO and the service R&D team to give it a neutral home so we can look at it more holistically and drive it aggressively. Because you find the operational guys get quite busy. They're not looking at the architectures in abstracted form. So that's quite interesting. And then I own innovation and incubation stuff, which is quite interesting. When I look at that, we've just gone through a process, my architecture team, where we've gone out and audited from a business process and system perspective 28 companies. And we've actually had to bring that back and say, well, how do you now put that into an enterprise architecture tool and then model it to find out what the best blueprint is? So I've just gone through 9 months of that. And I can tell you that firstly, when I look at it, it is the most unbelievable learning curve because our clients are going through the same challenges. So we've just done it at a scale that is probably unheard of in the industry. So when I do sit in front of a CIO and I say, I think I know what you're going through. I think we have an approach, or at least we have a perspective. It really is one based on experience. And so that is very, very strong. For us, bringing that together was interesting because we are at the point we've already gone through that process. We've actually built the models in terms of how to prioritize, and we've got a clear architecture roadmap that now defines the execution process. So all of that's really helped. When you look at it, when I say complementary business, let's take the data center business. We're taking Raging Y in the US, and you're bringing eShelter in Europe and, say, NetMagic in India. they're all data center companies in different regions. So some people don't realize it's not that these companies are all overlapping and they're all competing with each other, and they're just different geographies. So bringing that together is actually not as hard as it might seem.
But how does that play at a deeper level of architecture? When you think about any enterprise, we go back to the 80s and the 90s and we had enterprise architects. They are very thin on the ground now because companies are in a state where they create an app that might only live for 3-4 months. It might live for 2 years. It might live for 10 years, depending upon where it sits in that enterprise. It means that having somebody who directs that traffic, directs that innovation, directs that build, is not something that suits a lot of companies. The size of organization you now are, you still need those skills. And those skills, as you say, translate to your very big customers. But when you've looked at all those companies, how much has that changed what you were doing previously at Dimension Data as you've looked at those other 27 companies and said, oh, they do that better than we did. That's something I can now use here and something that we as a group can really execute on.
Obviously, there's a lot of best practice we harvested and brought together, both from an internal system and automation perspective, particularly in the service delivery side. Also in between, if you look at a Raging Wire, maybe compared to East Shelter, just as an example, they all have different areas of strength that you can bring together. And that's been very interesting. It's hard to call. There's so many different aspects to bringing so many together. I think if I look at it, though, probably one of the biggest learnings, I think you've got to create an environment where you can actually allow the leverage to flourish. I really am a believer in getting your architecture sorted out. Increasingly, where we're looking at loosely coupled architectures that are programmable in nature, where you can say sometimes we'll integrate, sometimes we'll consolidate. And sometimes when you look at bringing best practices together, you might want to consolidate. And other times you want to say, well, let me coexist, but let me create an environment where I can, things like normalize, I can get the leverage going to drive a consistent client experience, but behind the scenes you can still live a little bit in your pockets. That's the blend that I think we've probably learned most from. And it's never easy. But all in all, I think we are comfortable that we've made strong progress. We know we have a plan. The plan might not be perfect, but, you know, we're executing a plan. And I think as we go, we'll pick up the learnings as well and make the corrections.
How much technology has been deprecated as you've gone through this? And how are you migrating the data in those systems into new systems?
You're going straight to the heart of, I think, the real value in a big integration like this. I think this is an opportunity where you get the underlying architectures right. You don't have that opportunity very often. We actually do have that opportunity, which is interesting from a competitive sense, because once we get through this merger, we'll be in pretty good nick from a digital perspective compared to maybe others who don't have this opportunity. When you look at, I can't remember the count. You know, I can look it up at some point, but we discovered in our audit thousands of applications. I mean, I say thousands. I can give you one example. In our RTSM suite across the 28 companies, I think between 28 companies, we had 70-plus instances of ServiceNow. But remember, some of these companies were a result of acquisition in their own right, and it's never been integrated or never have been consolidated. So you actually, a lot of technical debt that you actually discover in this. And now we actually say, oh, well, if you have that, then naturally let's gravitate to one standard. And then we actually start figuring out how you decouple, say, the CMDB from the actual application, and then how you consolidate that. From that perspective, there's been a real strong consolidation. And then out of that, anything that's outside that standard has just been deprecated. So I would say, if you look at how many apps, I can probably say percentage-wise, I'd say 40% plus of the apps we discovered are just being deprecated.
That's a substantial number. One of the advantages of deprecating is many of the cyber attacks we're seeing at the moment, they come in and they exploit older technologies. They exploit where systems haven't been patched. How much is this ability to deprecate, but more importantly, how much is this ability to re-architect the enterprise, giving you that chance to relook at security and make sure that everything is now where it needs to be?
You've answered the question already. Naturally, we are architecting to be absolutely secure as much as you can. Part of the deprecation decision has always been around some of the older applications. Some of them do exist. I mean, you can't get rid of all of them. If you look at the architectural approach we've taken, we have our own security operation, which has a very interesting sort of negative day predictive approach to security. So that's pretty much embedded. We're using our own services to secure our own environment. And then down through the layers, we've allocated a CISO into our service organization. for exactly this purpose, to actually start reviewing our own governance. And, you know, now it's also a whole opportunity to consolidate how we take an approach to things like GDPR or Patriot Act or sovereignty. So there's all of that going on. We're starting to look at different techniques. Our discovery is not just securing through traditional means, but we're also looking at some new emerging technologies to assist us, things like edge computing, to do visualization in countries of sovereignty, for instance, so we don't have to pull data back or take data out to do visualization. So it is actually a rehaul of, you know, not just the architecture, but bringing those principles in and securing a bit easier. I'm touching a lot of subjects in one response there, but it is so embedded. And touching on things like edge computing, we're starting to see massive potential in using that to not have to move data around. It's interesting discoveries in this whole process.
How have your staff taken to this? Let's talk about just the IT, not the business first. Because IT staff have been kind of left out on a limb over the last 15, 20 years. Ever since we saw those Learn X in 21-day books, people have just thrown them at developers and operations team and said, right, we're taking on this application, go read that book and become the expert in it. But the reality is, in a fast-moving and complex environment, you A, don't have time to read the book, and B, what time is spent on a course actually is well worth it down the line. Are you finding your staff are looking at this as a retraining opportunity? Are the IT staff themselves invested and keen to make this happen?
It's interesting. We should talk to our CIO, who actually, so we do architecture. He does the actual deployment and operations. He's had to reorganize his own organization. The benefit, when you get into 28 companies, you find that the way they've staffed the internal IT, it varies. Some are well-staffed and some are very poorly staffed. And so it is an opportunity to reorganize the teams. We've done it by value stream. We're looking at business process by value stream. You can start looking at a process end-to-end. You can look at all your stakeholders in that value stream and actually drive your dev cycles or your integration cycles as a business process value stream. We're organizing around value streams. The organization have taken this as an opportunity to reskill, but reskill means some people have retrained and have gone out of their way to reskill themselves, and others we've had to bring in new staff, new skills. So it's a bit of a mix. I think we now, there's still areas where we're short. I think there's some obvious areas in the market where things like we get into the weeds of a proper data platform or analytics. It's still early days, and I think there's still some light skills there, but it's been a bit of a combination.
One of the things you have alongside this is you have a consulting organization that works closely with the customers. More importantly, it works closely with the partners as well. As you've changed your architecture, how much can you take that best practice and devolve that out to your own consulting team and your partners to take that forward to customers to help them know what is now considered good practice? When you do that, there always becomes that question mark of, well, if we show them too much of what we do, we open up risks to our own business.
We're in that process. We're busy executing. So I think the learnings, and as we go through it, will improve and increase, and we will be very open. We're actually very transparent with our clients and with yourselves. At the end of the day, you might as well be transparent and honest, because you get caught out otherwise. These days, it's very evident if you don't make it. What we are doing increasing, I mean, I look at my architecture team. If I can package what we've learned, I think people will die to get their hands on it. And that is something that we've seen. That's something that we're starting to see. How do we do that? But it comes back to, you need very different enterprise architect to then equipped with it to say, lead this or share this with a client. We're definitely looking into that. The areas where we've actually done it slightly differently, you talk about how do we deal with it from our partners and how do we actually share this. If I look at the technology strategy in my area, you know, we're starting to look at this, I want to say, a lot more aggressive than we've ever have in the past. Let me give you an example. I have different lenses I look through and I say, let's just evaluate a new partner that comes into the mix, and we have to build services around it. It's a life cycle engagement. How do we look through it? There's obvious things we look at, your commercial models and strategic fits and those things. But one of the things I'd look at that weighs heavily is programmability. Mm-hmm. I will personally run, my team will run an API scorecard, and I will very quickly see whether somebody truly is API first, or whether they're just a console and API is an afterthought, or whether their own console is just a curtain to their API, and then we score it. If in our minds a partner is not programmable enough, we will not engage them. For the simple reason that as we actually now drive a whole next generation service model through automation, through programmability, through reference architectures, and drive that automation, it's just not feasible to include those. And so some, even the mainstream vendors, are battling to keep up. And so we're putting a lot more pressure. The conversations I'm having with partners in terms of you have to do X, particularly on programming, has changed dramatically in the last 3 months. Dramatically.
One of the issues that we're seeing with APIs and programmability is very similar to what we saw with web services in the early 2000s. People are so desperate to turn everything into an API. There's no rewriting. There's no planning of the API. There's no attempt to bring security in to make sure that API is secure. That creates a danger, because when we have machine-to-machine communication, if to the security system it's a valid API call, it will allow it through, it won't flag it. But as we know, a valid API call can have a whole bunch of invalid statements hidden behind it. When you're assessing your own APIs, when you're looking at your customers' APIs and your partners' APIs and trying to build and maintain this mass of programmability, how challenging is security?
It is. It's very challenging. What we've done is, and it gets into our service, our platforms for our services. We've built what we just loosely refer to as a service layer, which is an abstraction. It's a microservices container-based abstraction of common services. That's where we drive the actual integration level to. That's where we deal with common things like identity and metering and all those sorts of things. And that's where we have a very strong discipline. Firstly, in terms of our own teams as they develop those microservices, where you're driving it through secure coding practices, you're driving a DevSecOps style model right as the guys run their sprints, and then you're driving a much stronger discipline on API gateways and what we actually allow and what we don't allow going out. We also expose some APIs we retain internally. We don't expose that externally, particularly when it gets into sensitive areas, north-south bound, and then east-west bound, typically through API gateways where we, you know, have the proper disciplines and governance and audit trails around what we're doing. The classic we see is people do a portal or a visualization and they start using a portal to integrate APIs, and it gets really messy very quickly. And it doesn't scale, and then it becomes a real problem, because that's typically where you find people starting to expose and all sorts of bad things. So I think it's the discipline. It's again the discipline around getting back to proper architecture principles, understanding what you're doing, and understanding where you put the right tools in to govern this.
You've mentioned principles a few times, and we've briefly touched on customers and best practice. But these are areas where customers lack massive amount of knowledge and skill and capability at the moment. How many customers are coming to you as you show them your new architecture and talk to them and saying, okay, we need this, we need this help, actually pushing you to go further in order that you have more lessons that you can then sell to them?
The first thing that I had, you'd be very honest and transparent, we're not a training organization that will give people the training of agile principles or safe agile, one of those, or teach them that. I think that's a very different discipline. What we do is we'll share our own transformation. 5-6 years ago, we took our R&D organization through that whole transformation. It was tough. We had to get Scrum Masters in there, actually. I mean, the walls looked like covered in sticky notes and the discipline, and people learn how to stand us properly. That's not something that we can share our experience, say this is how we do it, this is what we did, but we would highly recommend that they actually plan a proper transformation and drive through that. What we typically see is when we start exposing some of the architectural principles back to, you know, where do you abstract, where you deal with reference architectures, how do you punch stuff out versus operate stuff, those type of things. Most enterprises would look at that and say, you know what, I actually need to follow that. That's a good approach. Where I think the challenge is, when you look at that approach in hindsight, it looks obvious and it looks easy, but to make things easy is actually complex. Mm-hmm. I think they underestimate the effort, and they underestimate often the cost or the skills that they then need to do it. And they go through cycles. They'll go through it, they'll tempt it, and then come back and say, can we integrate to yours? And that's fine with us. I think that's the type of relationship that we would encourage. And then we'll take it through again back to a value stream base. You don't just integrate or connect. You go much further. You drive them as a value stream, and you make them part of your own. And that's been something that's worked well.
Repeatability is a great thing, and programmability gives you that opportunity for repeatability. But you mentioned earlier some of the challenges with legislation, with laws in different parts of the world. You pulled out the Cloud Act, you pulled out GDPR, you mentioned some others. You're not operating in any one region. You are operating with different business units in different markets. More importantly, many of those customers overlap those different markets and different businesses. When you look at your own environment, how do you ensure that as you try and increase the cadence of delivery, you don't run into problems with legislation? And how many of your customers are really, really aware of the challenge that all of that brings to you?
If clients are always aware of the challenge it brings to us, they're very strict on ensuring that we abide by the laws and the governance. Of course, we have to, otherwise they won't engage us. There's two lenses internally we use. One is obviously we have to be compliant as our own systems and our own governance. But then obviously when you start looking at how we do managed services, where we start touching client environments and there's sensitivity around personal identifiable information and all sorts of things, we have to be very careful. Again, you look at this, I always come back to architecture, but we do try and make sure that we have a hierarchical architecture around our service platforms that do allow us, and this is probably the other very pivotal point, is increasingly we own our own IP in that space. Because if you have your own IP, you can start reusing it to pursue the right architectural principles as opposed to commercials getting in the way. So let me try and explain that. If you do something like moves, adds, and changes in a collaboration environment where you're now dealing with usernames and email addresses, that's the heart of GDPR, of course. If you own the MACD engine and you can put it close to the client without a commercial impact, you can actually maintain compliance easy. As opposed to where you're using somebody else's tool sets and now you have a commercial impact, suddenly if you want to centralize it, then you're into trouble with things like GDPR. So increasingly we are investing in that development to allow us to have that distributed architecture where we don't run into trouble with GDPR. And the same thing when it comes to sometimes then you start saying, well, you've got the ability to invest in the scale processing at the central delivery level and platform level. You can do some of the compliancy stuff close to where the data should be. And then the other thing is, how do you then bring together the visualization? Things like edge computing starts playing where we can say, well, we've got some of the data locally. Although the visualization engines might sit centrally, we can take a simplified stack, run it on a container at the edge and suddenly do the same visualization, but contain the integrity of what we're trying to achieve. So that's the type of things that we do to stay within governance and compliance, but not sacrifice or compromise what we're trying to achieve from a service perspective.
You're busy trying to pull together a whole mess of things at the moment, but you've mentioned a bunch of other things there. You mentioned edge computing a few times, you've mentioned containers, but let's start to look at other technologies we see coming on the horizon. We've got machine learning is taking off, artificial intelligence is taking off, we've got homomorphic encryption, but we've got neural networks. We've got people wanting extremely scaled up IoT and analytic environments. Some of these are here today. Some of them are not. Some of them are being worked on by your own research teams around the world. If I was to ask you to name four technologies that you want in the next year that fit into your architecture as it is at the moment, what are they and why?
I'm going to just run them straight out as they come to mind. And there's probably a lot more than four that we want, but you know, the ones that I actually at the moment are really focused around, the first is not just technology, it's more the principles of data architecture. Mm-hmm. To me, the architecting a data platform now that I can decouple data from applications, create it in an architecture that I can expose the data in all its glory through maybe a service catalog and enable it through APIs to different parties to manipulate, analyze, use an AI is probably my primary requirement. And we're going through that as we speak. I then would say my next level up to say is to really get into that. I'm going to categorize that as AI machine learning pattern matching technologies. Increasingly, and I can branch off into some of the interesting projects we're doing in this space in a second, but using those technologies to derive a very different quantum of experience or quantum of service delivery. That's where I'm really driving a big focus. I'm taking categories. I'm not answering your question very well in terms of specific ones. They do complement. So that's sort of two categories. The third one is a lot of stuff coming around things like data virtualization, mm-hmm. getting into that a little bit to say, what can we do? Can we use some of those technologies to also support what I'm trying to do with AI and some of those technologies? That would be one. And then the final one, maybe it's just a personal passion and interest, maybe not making difference for us, but making a little bit more difference for clients and what how people consume is the realities of Wi-Fi 6 and 5G. Particularly when you start talking about getting the sense or getting the data from IoT devices into some of the data platforms, increasingly starting to see those two. I think there are realities of 5G that people don't understand. There's some very positive things happening with Wi-Fi 6 that might push it ahead of 5G. We can go into that if you want. But those are probably the key things. Let me give you some context around that. We're using some of this. We're the technology partner for the Tour de France, as you know. And so we've been going through an interesting 3 years of bringing them from analog to digital. When we engage with them, things like speed was done with somebody riding on a motorcycle next to bicycle riders and then looking at the speedometer, writing it on a chalkboard and showing it to the TV cameras. So we've had to put IoT devices, GPS chips, all those sorts of things on bikes, and then we do all these cool things now where we've got the data platform sorted out and we're driving machine learning and AI to do predictive stuff. Tell you maybe one or two of the quick predictive successes we're having. We've got a lot of data. I don't want to get into all the data, but every GPS reading we take, we enrich with 53 different metrics to then create a very rich data set. And we use that into things like AI algorithms that starts getting into predictive algorithms that give us a view of who we think might win a stage. In the past Tour de France, it was interesting to see, we were pushing our predictions out a couple of hours before a stage every day. The broadcaster started picking this up. And they said, oh, this is interesting, computer-generated predictions of who the winners might be on the stage. And then the journalists got stuck and they said, no, we're the journalists, we know what's going on, we'll make our predictions. And so very quickly the broadcasters picked up the predictions versus the journalists and started comparing and having great conversations. The long and the short is, every prediction we made went through a decision tree of 150,000 nodes in terms of its decision tree. During the 3 weeks of the Tour de France, our software made 100 trillion decisions to do the predictions. The reason I've called that out is that you cannot do this with humans. And the scale of that type of decision-making and granularity rendered a very interesting outcome. When we looked at the Tour de France, how accurate were we? Our accuracy, our probability of our top five coming in the top 10 was 72.3%. Now, if you just guess, the probability is about 2%. We've gone from 2% to 72%. And then when we looked at that in comparison to journalists, our algorithms now are about the same level of maturity as a cycling journalist with 30 years of experience. So when you look at the facts and the statistics we're getting out of these things, that's why I'm saying I need more of that in my service platforms, in my own platforms, in my own systems.
What intrigues me about that is that one of our challenges around expert systems in the 80s and 90s and now machine learning and AI in 2010 to 2020 period, is that we lack the subject matter expert knowledge. We talk regularly about how do we take that information from them and how do we codify it. Yet you're managing to do that by using the technology as we stand. How easy is it to translate that into a wider industry benefit?
That's a good question. I think it comes back to skills again. There's not enough. It's in its infancy, this whole AI and machine learning. A lot of people, I think approaching it too theoretical. Our approach has been very much an applied fashion. It's applied to a specific problem. See what we can get out of it, and then we're getting these wonderful insights. I think that's teaching us how to do it in practice. I think it's, again, time, as people invest in the skills and actually get into it and they do it. I'll quickly double as you talk about how easy it is to cross-reference in the industry some of these. Let me give you one other example. When you think about the Tour de France once again, it's 176 riders this year. It's teams of eight. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things we're trying to do is discover stories and visualizations we can give to broadcasters and fans to understand the sport better, to see the tactics, to understand the athletes, all sorts of cool things. But one of the things we were doing this year, you come talking about machine learning. We created, I want to use the analogy of drone swarm technology. Mm-hmm. So if you think about a drone swarm, you've got to track every drone in isolation, you've got to track every drone in context to its neighbors, mm-hmm. and you've got to track the whole swarm. Mm-hmm. So apply that to a cycling team of eight riders in a peloton. Suddenly, if you apply that principle, you say, oh, wait a minute, if I track them, I can now detect their pattern as a swarm. And suddenly I can start comparing in real time, detecting their pattern and comparing that to known patterns, such as an attacking pattern or a defensive pattern or an at-ease pattern. The whole idea is so fascinating. We've got this going with machine learning. We link it to a Slack channel, and then we call it Le Buzz, the buzz meter. The buzz meter goes off, and we sort of all look and say, well, what happened? First stage happened in Brussels, and everything is going well, and about 10 kilometers from the end, the buzz meter goes off, and we're all looking at the TVs and saying, well, what on earth is going on? Well, nothing's going on. And a kid, you know, 90 seconds later, Vote for an Art, one of the favorites, he falls, he comes off. And this is machine learning at its best. Now we want to understand, what did the machine see? Why did this happen? So we rewound it, and then we realized that the distance vector, that swarm approach, the distance vector that crossed the threshold of safety, the road narrowed at a feeding station. And so suddenly the peloton got squeezed, the distance vector got into the danger, and the buzz went off and said, something's going to happen. And true's not, something happened. One of the key guys fell. Our learning out of that is that even when you go into machining, if you apply it again, you know, take a pragmatic view of it, you can get real interesting things going. But even so, you still have to figure out sometimes what the machine's learning. That is the machine learning. You've got to still figure out how to interpret what the machine's learning. And so these are the types of things we're doing in practical, to also learn to see. You might say, well, why is that important for us? I can tell you, taking that principle of pattern matching, I can take that to a data center and start running patterns on, you know, thermals on servers and start saying, that pattern tells me that that server rack is going to go. So let's get preventative around it. And that's where we start to apply this. So interesting, very interesting stuff.
That's just very cool. Etienne, thank you for your time today.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.